pay for Chase.
Abstract number one. Predictors of laryngospasm during 276,832 episodes of pediatric procedural sedation. This is by Cosgrove et al. From Annals of Emergency Medicine.
No, I'm sorry. You said two. I'm taking notes. 276,832 is in the title.
You know, I'm going to say this. If you want to be a paper chaser, right, you can do something different with the title. That's when putting the exact number of patients in it. Exact.
Yeah.
Is very different. I've never seen that before. But a prospectively collected study of 250,000 patients, that's going to be a paper chaser.
Do you think that you would have, I mean, it made the paper chase anyway, but do you think 250,000 patients written like that would be even more, like, you know, baller?
It'd come off the tongue, roll off the tongue a little bit better. So this is a pretty interesting paper. Of all the potential complications of pediatric procedural sedation, laryngospasm is probably the most serious. It's certainly the one we think about a lot. We don't see it a lot, but I think it's the one kind of in our brains because it introduces the risks of hypoxemia, potentially needing to intubate somebody, bradycardia, aspiration, cardiac arrest. However, risk factors for laryngospasm have been difficult to identify, as this is a very rare complication of procedural sedation, making a prospective evaluation challenging because you really would need a large sample size to see any laryngospasm at all. Essentially, all previous publications on the topic because of this problem have been underpowered, and the meta-analyses, where they try to sort of put a bunch of different studies together to come up with an answer, are limited by the facts that each of the studies included has different doses and types of medications used, the patients enrolled were a little bit different, and the outcomes they were looking at and the definitions of those outcomes, how do you define the laryngospasm, also different between the different studies. So in this study, the authors analyzed the largest multi-center database of pediatric sedation with the goal of quantifying an accurate prevalence of laryngospasm and performing a predictor analysis of biologically plausible predictors of laryngospasm. So this is a secondary analysis of the Pediatric Sedation Research Consortium multi-center database from 64 sites, which include various types of medical care facilities. So it's not just EDs. It's academic hospitals, it's community hospitals, it's freestanding imaging centers, so places where kids could go just to get an MRI or something like that, and even dental offices.
Oh, I was going to ask if the dental offices were in there.
Yeah, it's got a few more too, so it's a pretty wide breadth of places getting these sedations. Similar to NEAR, the sites were mandated to submit full data that was accurate, complete, etc., for more than 90% of their procedural sedations they performed on pediatric patients in order to minimize selection bias. So it wasn't like they were just submitting the easy ones or the hard ones. If you weren't hitting that 90% of all of them mark, you're kicked out of this consortium. So they had a bar. They really wanted to get a full picture of what pediatric sedation looked like. The primary outcome of laryngospasm was defined as the complete or near complete lack of air movement with respiratory effort and with or without stridor, not relieved by chin repositioning or an oral or nasal airway. As the title states, they report on over 250,000 sedations over a 7-year period. That's just like a mind-boggling number.
Yeah, we're at a pretty big institution, and we do a lot of sedations. But 250,000 feels like a lot.
I mean, you know, we talk about 250,000 patients. These are usually like, you know, they look at like international databases and stuff like that.
Yeah, they're usually looking at like population data. Like, you know, like this is how maternal mortality
they're
in
not prospectively
Sub-Saharan
collected
Africa
for this purpose. Right. You know, it really is impressive that this thing was done and got published. Overall, there were 913 kids who had laryngospasm for an overall unadjusted prevalence of 3.3 cases per 1,000 sedations. The most common interventions performed were jaw thrusts, about 75%, bag valve mask, 55%, and only 49 kids, or 5%, got endotracheal intubation. 7 kids got a nasotracheal intubation, and cardiac arrest basically occurred in 1 case overall.
So it's 5% of 0.3%.
You got it.
Okay.
They ran a multivariable regression with laryngospasm as a dependent variable and lots of different independent variables. I had a big sample, including age, ASA category, presence of an upper respiratory infection, location of the procedure, kind of what type of procedure it was, airway procedure, painful procedure, something like that, and the medications used. And they found that a younger age, a higher ASA category, a concurrent respiratory infection, which had an adjusted odds ratio of about 4, and an airway procedure being performed, which had an adjusted odds ratio of 3.73, were associated with an increased risk of laryngospasm.
So a small airway that's inflamed and that you're mucking with.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
It's not terribly surprising, yeah. I guess, but good to see sort of the odds ratios of how more risky is that.
And that there's not some weird thing that I wouldn't have anticipated in there, like kids with diabetes, whatever, you know.
Great point.
Yeah.
So it is things that make sense. Not too surprising. Interestingly, maybe a little bit more surprising, compared with propofol alone, propofol combination regimens had increased risk as well. So propofol plus ketamine, and I know we talk a lot about ketafol, is it better or worse, whatever, had an adjusted odds ratio of laryngospasm of 2.52. Propofol dexmedetomidine, 2.1, and a few other things too. When you put propofol with something, it was worse. They did several sensitivity analyses. They had a lot of data to play with here, including limiting the population to just the ED, so just the ED patients, which actually was a pretty small portion in this overall sample, still a large number overall, and ketafol remained an independent predictor of laryngospasm. In case you were curious, in terms of location, speaking of the ED had the lowest adjusted odds ratio for laryngospasm.
Nice job, guys.
And the endoscopy suite had the highest.
Boo.
By provider type, ED docs had the lowest unadjusted laryngospasm prevalence, actually 0 cases in their study.
Really?
When an ED doc was doing it in the ED, they didn't see any laryngospasm.
I have actually seen this. So I did not fill out my case report form.
We're not a site. Yeah, they had a difference. But, and the highest were anesthesiologists and intensivists, basically tied for the highest. So this is an absolutely massive data set. And in truth, the statistical methods are stellar. But some limitations include that it's observational data, right? We don't know why ketafol or propofol was used in some case. So the findings that they observe might be due to unmeasured confounders. We don't know, like I said, why certain medications were used. There's no controlling for site. We have no information on dosing data. So if, you know, maybe larger doses, they got a bigger dose of overall sedative and that was the problem and not the combination. And almost half of the sedations, 40-something percent, occurred in radiology departments. So to get an imaging or something. So translating that back to ED patients.
That's really too bad about the dosing issue because, you know, my understanding, and again, this is going back a long time since I've really looked into this, is that physiologically, the problem is typically underdosing, right? You're in that mid sedation phase where the larynx gets temporarily activated. I forget what it's called in the anesthesia literature, the second phase or whatever of anesthesia. And I wonder if that's in radiology suites, they're nervous and they worry. And so they give a little less, whereas I think we're pretty comfortable and we probably give heavy doses. I typically give pretty heavy doses of things and I'm very eager to give enough to make sure they are down. And I'm less worried about having to take an airway because I know how to do it.
No, I think that's an excellent point. And I wish they gave it too. That's why it's a big limitation. Yeah. You know, another thing to think about here is that although the identified high-risk features did generate statistically significant increases in odds, right? These like 4x odds and stuff like that. The absolute differences were very, very small because laryngospasm itself is just so rare. So you're kind of going from like super duper duper rare to super duper rare.
Right. You know? Still probably not worth freaking out about one way or the other.
Yeah. I think that, you know, the clinical significance of it is a little bit questionable. I'm sure they have it. I'm sure they have data on other adverse events, right? Because they were just looking at laryngospasm. What about just hypoxia? What about hypotension? I hope that they have that stuff. I hope it's coming because this is just too rich of a data set to leave with just this one step.
Yeah, and if they do have that, I'm going to recommend that they put in the title, Predictors of Hypotension During a Quarter Million Episodes of Pediatric Procedural Sedation.
If they could do the Mike Myers little twist up of the pinky.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
That'd be even better.
Editor's commentary.
In this massive report of over a quarter million pediatric sedations, the authors report statistically higher odds of laryngospasm in younger kids, those with higher ASA scores, respiratory infections, getting airway procedures, and when using combination of sedation agents like ketoprofen. But the absolute differences were very small, bringing into question the magnitude of the clinical impact. I still think it's good to be aware of these high-risk features before starting a sedation, and I would be curious to know if other, more common adverse events were also associated with them, which might change the way I practice and the medications that I choose.